Hello and welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast 138. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing two movies from 2016. The first is M. Night Shyamalan's Split, the second in a trilogy of superhero movies that he is making. The third one, Glass, is coming out very soon. And the other one's an English zombie movie, The Girl with All the Gifts, starring Glenn Close and Gemma Arterton. So, a zombie movie and also a kind of subterranean superhero movie. So anyway, I'll get the contact details out of the way and we can start talking about both of those things. Martian Drive-In Podcast is a two-weekly podcast about science fiction, fantasy, and other genres, cinema and television. From George Méliès to the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Extended Universe, anything's up for grabs in this podcast. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. And if you want to give feedback, you can go to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com and leave a voicemail or an email message. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, adult concepts and words may turn up. So if you're going to be listening to them with kids around, put on the headphones. Or if you can't do that, you're going to have a lot of explaining to do. Okay, so how is everybody? It's going fine here, in spite of the fact it's still cold and wet. In fact, I'll give you a weather report.
Currently in Tarnit, it's 13 degrees and mostly cloudy. Today, there'll be scattered showers with a forecast high of 13 and a low of 7.
There's no use having a Google Home Mini in your man cave unless you got to use it. See, I can even do it for music, so if I go, hey Google, give me a beat.
Sure. I know a guy. Hold on, I'll get him.
See, better living through technology. The plans for the trip to Japan in April next year are going ahead really nicely. We've paid for the tickets, we've paid for the accommodation. So the two big things are nailed down, which is kind of good. And thank you to the Australian Taxation Office for financing the trip to Japan. We're going to be going to Tokyo, Osaka, and with a side trip to Hiroshima for the day, kind of like those American pilots did in 1945. Yeah, we're going to do Tokyo Disney Sea, which is the grown-ups' end of Disneyland. We're also doing the Universal Studios tour in Osaka. So, yeah, I should podcast from now. I know I'm going to be doing some YouTube videos with Sal, but I'm going to see if I can knock out a few podcasts while we're in Japan as well, because that might be useful content. Let me know if you want to hear some podcasts from Japan, because I think that might be a bit of fun and a way of filling in the evenings after we're exhausted from running around like mad people trying to see everything in a country of 128 million people. So we're both quite excited by all this and really looking forward to it. So yeah, it's actually going to happen. As soon as the passports come through, it'll definitely be nailed down. And it's just given us something to look forward to, given us something to plan for, and it's improved our morale enormously. I'm going to have to pick up a lot of DVDs and Blu-rays, I think. I'll really hit that pretty hard once we get there. So, yeah, it's all a bit squee. So, anyway, I should get on with the show instead of just gloating there. It's time to find out what media I have been consuming. And so I put this together to introduce that particular segment.
What has Terry been watching?
Yeah, you can't get a Google Home to repeat sentences, so I had to cut and paste that for a number of different answers to questions I made up. What have I been watching? So I'll crank up the Letterboxd and let you know. Because we want to do the Studio Ghibli tour when we go to Japan, is it Ghibli or Ghibli? I'll have to ask my good friend Grant Watson about that. I introduced Sal to My Neighbor Totoro, which was great. It went over well. The cat bus, the soot sprites, Totoro, the kids and the parents, all everything just kind of gelled. It was great revisiting that. There's a really nice Blu-ray release here in Australia with a lot of extras. It's a steelbook edition. It's a little pricey, but I bit the bullet and bought it, and I don't regret it for one second. Then while I was kind of casting around for a movie to do for the podcast, I watched a Vincent Price 3D movie. It's not House of Wax. It is a black and white one, The Mad Magician, which is kind of interesting and almost like either a remake or a prelude to House of Wax. It's not as good, but it's still got its moments of kind of goofy goriness in the 1950s manner. It's worth checking out if you're in the mood for a bit of Vincent Price. Then I did a Don Siegel movie from the 1960s, which I hadn't seen for a very long time, and that was Madigan with Richard Widmark. It's also got Inga Stevens in it, Henry Fonda, James Whitmore. Really good ensemble cast. It's a kind of police procedural on the gritty streets of New York. In fact, the streets were so gritty in New York in 1968, I think it was, that after a few incidents, they had to film the finale in Los Angeles because it was too dangerous to keep filming the movie on the streets of New York, which is kind of interesting. They had some problems like that in the 1970s, I believe, with a number of productions as well. But it was worthwhile. It span off a TV series with the titular character played by Widmark in the movie, in the TV series, which, given the way the movie plays out, was kind of interesting. But you should check it out. There's some fine acting in it. And the action sequences are very much of the 1960s, but they're well done. Don Siegel knew what he was doing with those kind of movies. And it kind of reminded me that I've got to watch more Don Siegel movies, apart from anything else. And I did enjoy that. I did see a DC animation as well, The Death of Superman from 2018, which tells the story of the death of Superman as in the comic books. It works. DC animations are really doing fantastically well, and in a lot of ways a lot better than the movies, and at least as good as the TV series that the CW are doing. So that one's recommended. I actually binged the whole first season of an anime TV series as well. I've really been dipping into the anime for reasons to do with the holidays. I wanted to look at some 21st century anime that might be of interest to me. And so I watched the whole first season of One Punch Man. Now, if you haven't heard about One Punch Man, it's about a superhero called Saitama, who started out as a kind of otaku, salaryman kind of guy, a bit of a loser, but he ended up exercising a lot and becoming the most powerful superhero in a world full of superheroes where they have a ranking system and they're licensed and registered and they're in different categories and all that kind of thing. And he always gets underestimated and he's always bored because every challenge he has as a superhero, he defeats the enemies with one punch. And so he gets a bit bored with that and a little bit kind of down about it. He has a couple of friends. He has a cyborg friend named Genos and a couple of other people with whom he eventually gets on. And it's done very much tongue-in-cheek and kind of counterintuitively to the genre of superhero series and also of anime itself. It's a lot of fun, and I enjoyed it. I'm looking forward to getting a little bit of One Punch Man merch when we go to Japan. So I watched that and enjoyed it, and I definitely recommend One Punch Man. And the only other thing I've really watched of any interest at all is a 1970s adaptation of an Alistair MacLean novel, Puppet on a Chain, which is set in Amsterdam and has a crazily good speedboat race through the canals of Amsterdam. That's kind of the bit that you want to watch the movie for, in a sense. It stars a guy called Sven Bertel Taub, who's a Swedish actor, still alive and still working, by the way. But it's got a pretty good supporting cast. People like Vladek Shabal turn up there. Barbara Parkins is in it. Alexander Knox, a whole bunch of interesting actors. But you go to see this movie basically, or you get the movie basically, to see a crazily good bit of real physical stunt work using speedboats. So that's pretty much what you're seeing the movie for. The rest of it's a bit of a kind of international criminal investigation thing about drug smuggling and other things like that. You can pretty much guess the twists and turns of the plot without too much effort. But that speedboat race really kicks ass. So I enjoyed watching that, mostly for whenever someone was behind the wheel of a very fast water vehicle. Anyway, we're going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to be talking about the first of the two movies. I'll do them in the order that I watched them. And that is M. Night Shyamalan's Split from 2016. And here now is the trailer.
Hey, pardon me, sir. I think you have the wrong car.
What are we doing here? What the hell is going on?
I was sent to get you for a reason.
There's a flower on the pillows, a flower in the bathroom, like we're important.
The only chance we have is if all three of us go crazy on this guy.
Who is that? Maybe she can help us.
We're here! Help us!
We're in here!
Don't worry. He's not allowed to touch you. He knows what you're here for. He listens to me.
My name's Hedwig.
How old are you?
9.
I've never seen a case like this before.
23 identities live in Kevin's body. Who are you?
Help me get out of here, Hedwig.
You trying to trick me? I'll tell on you.
Aren't you the clever one?
An individual with multiple personalities can change their body chemistry with their thoughts.
Someone's coming for you.
Who's coming?
The Beast.
There's a man here. He abducted us and he's going to kill me. We're meant for something. Something horrible.
The world will understand now. The Beast is real.
He's done awful things to people, and he'll do awful things to you.
Okay, so Split is a 2016 American psychological horror film, it says here in Wikipedia. Co-produced and directed by M. Night Shyamalan. Stars James McAvoy, Anya Taylor-Joy, and Betty Buckley. It's the story of a man with 23 different personalities who kidnaps and imprisons 3 teenage girls in an isolated underground facility. One of his darker personalities manifests within his psyche and results in his eventual transformation into a merciless and cannibalistic sociopath with superhuman abilities. Now, from here on, it gets spoilery. I had the big twist at the end of this movie spoiled for me because social media sucks in some ways, but I don't think it really disappointed me much because the spoiler in itself was a nice reveal, and the twist in the tail of this one, that it is the second in a trilogy of movies that Night has made, was pretty fucking cool. They're calling the trilogy the Eastrail 177 trilogy, which is the name of the train that Bruce Willis's character David Dunn was on at the start of the first movie in the series, Unbreakable. Some people are calling it the Unbreakable series, some calling it Eastrail 177 trilogy. I'm going to call it something different. I'm going to call it the Unbreakable Split Glass trilogy, because the third in the series has just had a trailer drop. And that movie is Glass, starring Samuel L. Jackson, Bruce Willis, and James McAvoy as the three characters that they played in the first two movies. Now, Knight is an interesting director in a lot of ways. He came out of the gate really hard with The Sixth Sense, which played against people's expectations and got him a big name. And then he made some rotten films for a while. But he does seem to be on getting his second wind and starting to produce movies of value these days. And that's kind of cool. And the fact that he's taken a totally different approach on the superhero genre, based on a movie 18 years ago that he did, Unbreakable, which itself is 8 years before the Marvel Cinematic Universe and took a totally different look at superheroes. I kind of like that. I like the fact that he was ahead of the curve in some ways. And now that superheroes are the flavor du jour, he's coming back with it and has brought out Split, but didn't tell anybody it was the second in a series. He left that for us to find at the tail end of it. And again, I said this a minutes ago, I'm getting spoilery here. And that's kind of cool. For a stage there, a bit in love with the Twilight Zone-y twist endings that he thought up. There were some really shit ones there, and we all know what they are. And I'm looking at you signs and The Happening and all those other things. But it kind of works. This movie's made $278 million on a budget of $9 million, so you've got to like that part of it. The fact that he kind of pulled a rabbit out of a hat where we didn't know there was a rabbit or a hat. And apart from the nice line of suspense that Knight puts into this one, there's some fine acting in here, and the movie does kind of do the slow reveal and reveals its twists in a very measured and interesting way. The protagonist of the film is actually Anya Taylor-Joy's character, Casey Cook, who's kind of emotionally withdrawn as a teenager. She's seen as a little bit of a freak and gets a lift with some classmates home from some kind of a school thing, and is then kidnapped by a guy called Kevin Wendell Crumb, who has dissociative identity disorder. They're trapped in an underground room and they don't know what's happening. And of the three of them, Casey is the most self-possessed because she has some secrets in her own past which have geared her towards being survival prone. We see some flashbacks in her life which show that she was taught how to shoot at a young age by her father and her uncle. And we kind of get that she's somebody who has been taught to think her way through problems as much as anything else. But there's a lot more to that reveal. I'm not going to do all the spoilers that I can for this movie. But the nature of Casey's background is one that really works. I think it's handled with sensitivity, and I think it's handled rightly. And it explains, when we find out what it actually is, it explains so much of her previous behaviors and a previous way of holding herself, and the fact that she's treated as a bit of a freak at school kind of fits. It's beautifully kind of locked together like a jigsaw puzzle, and that really works for me because my home background has some similarities to hers, and there's a survival attitude that comes from various forms of, and various forms of abuse, which people who haven't experienced that can't really know in depth. It's an attitude of the world and a way of looking at the world when there are threats that is very, very different than the way other people react to various things that may cause stress or an existential threat to somebody. We handle and understand that differently. So it's a very nice piece of writing, the Casey character. Then we get on to Kevin himself, played by James McAvoy, who's got all the different personalities in there. There's Barry and there's Dennis, of course, Patricia, a woman, and Hedwig, who's a 9-year-old child. And they all have different IQs. One of them, in fact, is diabetic. So when the personality is dominant, it has to take insulin because one of the, well, the superpower, in a sense, that Kevin manifests is the extreme physical changes that each personality manifests upon Kevin's body. And that, of course, leads ultimately to the 24th personality, the Beast, who we find out manifests the strength of various kinds of animals. His skin gets really thick. He becomes immensely strong, immensely agile to a degree which is in itself a superpower. There's no way that it isn't, though it is based on an animal's particular skills. And the Beast is an interesting and really fascinating kind of twist on the supervillain, in the sense that not all of Kevin's personalities are malignant. Some of them are reasonable. One of them, the one that kidnaps the children, well, the girls, because the girls are teenagers, so in the legal sense they are children, has a fetish for seeing young girls dance naked. So it's not a fetish in the sense of being rapey, but it is an assault fetish in that sense. This isn't overplayed, because that kind of a problem and that kind of a glitch could overbalance the movie from the other themes that Knight wants this movie to be about. That's not to dismiss that kind of a thing, but to focus on it more than he did would make it voyeuristic, I think. And he's kind of got a balancing act in a couple of ways here. One of the problems that some people have had with this movie is that they say that it kind of villainizes people with dissociative identity disorder, and that it's seen as a very negative thing by various kinds of people in, well, various people in various kinds of disability advocacy groups. And I can see and I kind of respect that approach, but this movie is a bit different. It's a bit like having Matt Murdock be blind, and a lot of people at the time when Daredevil came out as a series in Netflix complained that a sighted actor was used to play a blind character. And I respect the opinions of people with disabilities to be represented, and representation matters. But I think with this one, you couldn't really have somebody with a dissociative identity disorder playing this character. And the whole point of the movie is this character, in a sense, and is the fact that he has the ability to have extreme changes of physiology and physiognomy as a part of this illness. So I think the way that this is handled by Knight is kind of interesting. That brings me to the most interesting character for me in this film, and probably the most valuable player as far as acting is concerned. And that is Dr. Fletcher, played by Betty Buckley, who is the psychiatrist handling Kevin as a patient. And she specializes in people with dissociative identity disorder. And Betty Buckley, who is 71 now, it's really nice, by the way, to see a major role in a movie being played by an older woman. So all props to the filmmakers for that. Her character is really fascinating. She's empathetic to people with DID. She's empathetic to Kevin himself. And she's not stupid. She knows when one of the other personalities is pretending to be him. One of them has obsessive compulsive disorder, and that kind of manifests in little clues that she picks up on. She wants to understand, and she's an advocate for people with that kind of a disorder. And so, as a way of addressing the concerns that some people have had with portraying a character with that particular complex, having such an empathetic and focused and really intelligent actor in that role kind of balances that out for me. It's a kind of thing where they're not saying that this guy's just crazy and all the people with DID are crazy. They're treating it seriously as one of the range of, you know, the mental spectrum of human beings. And Betty Buckley's character, Dr. Fletcher, is really kind of interesting in that way. She gives us a fully lived-in character. And I really like that. It works tremendously well. And just watching her do this is pretty fantastic. She's basically, being an actor on Broadway for a very long time now. She's done musicals. She was in Cats, which we'll forgive her for. She was in a number of movies, including Tender Mercy. She played Norma Desmond in the musical Sunset Boulevard. Again, we'll forgive her for another Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. And she'd been in a number of movies. She was actually in a previous M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Happening, in 2008. She was in Tender Mercies in 1983, and she played one of the teachers, the gym teacher, in Brian De Palma's Carrie. So she's got a history with the genre, but she's also got a history of being a really fine actor and being kind of the best of the best in that particular art form. And that's kind of cool, getting somebody like that in rather than one of the usual suspects really works for me. And I suppose that part of it was the fact that there were budgetary limitations. You couldn't get Meryl Streep to play this role, for instance, because that would have been the whole budget and more. But Betty Buckley was a really good choice for this. And I like the way her character's there. And I like the fact that Betty Buckley is an actor who has a lived-in face. She isn't what somebody who's turned her face into a tight porcelain mask, the way a number of other female actors of her vintage have done. And that kind of lived-in and wonderful face. And that's what Cassavetes said, wasn't it? You know, the most wonderful thing is a human face. And having a human face with the years she's lived showing on it and having her use that as part of her toolkit to give us a really interesting and realistic character is all credit to her. I really like Dr. Fletcher in this movie. I think she's definitely the person that every time she came on the screen, I watched carefully and watched the way that she did the line readings and the physicality of the actor. It just kind of worked. And it gave me something that I really loved seeing in movies, which is really fine veteran actors at the top of their game, giving us a kind of lesson in exactly what the craft can give a movie. Even a movie like this, which is a $9 million budget movie, basically about a monstrous supervillain. And yet Betty Buckley does this fantastic and subtle piece of acting, which grounds the whole thing in reality in a way that really works well for the whole piece. And I do like that. If you look over the career of Knight himself, he does have a skill for picking and bringing out the best in certain actors. I mean, something like The Sixth Sense and also Unbreakable brought out the best in Bruce Willis as an actor. And he's an actor who, in spite of the fact he does have significant skills, really cashed checks for a long time. He really hasn't cared about what he was doing. I mean, if you look at the way he treated, say, the recent Death Wish reboot, there's nothing there, really. It's there are moments when it kind of works, but I think that Willis really needs something to chew on as far as an actor and commit to. I mean, yeah, he's crazily wealthy. He can't have had a career since 1989 and been very successful the way Bruce Willis has without, you know, racking up the dough. So there's no kind of economic imperative for him to do fine work. But I think that there's a possibility, with the right material, of him really kind of giving us something we haven't seen yet. I'm optimistic about that. I don't know whether it'll happen. From all accounts, he's quite difficult to work with at times. But I do think that the potential is there. And it is something I'd like to see. It's a, you know, a part of his career. I'd like to get that kind of end to Bruce Willis's career as an actor, where he does some significant work in the same way, I suppose, that Betty Buckley is with her character of Dr. Fletcher in Split. But that's just me being a little bit of a Pollyanna optimist about these things. There are actors I like that I want to do well, even if personally they're not the best of human beings. It's a kind of an not wasting the potential of somebody's skills and somebody's ability to, you know, give us something that is memorable and important. Just to wrap up on Split, it works well as a superhero movie. Once you realise what it is, it works well as a thriller, it works well as a character piece, and it works well as a psychological thriller with all of the psychiatric aspects to it as well. I'm not trying to kind of dismiss James McAvoy's contribution, because he gets the kind of spotlight piece character in this, where he gets to play a whole bunch of different people, and that works, and I think he does it with a great deal of skill and a great deal of ingenuity, and the different voices for the characters really work well. I'm not trying to dismiss his acting at all in this piece, but I think that the ensemble around him are in some ways much more interesting characters. The bad guy in this case isn't the one that I was focusing on. I was focusing on Casey, and I was focusing on Dr. Fletcher for some reason. But that may have been just the mood I was in at the time, and I'm fully willing to accept that possibility. But, yeah, definitely see it. If you haven't seen Split, definitely see it. Rewatch Unbreakable first. I would advise that because there are thematic similarities, and they do show that this guy's a good writer and a good director when he gets his finger, you know, the pedal to the metal. But, yeah, I enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to seeing Glass. I may well go and see it in the cinema rather than waiting because I want to see the third part of this trilogy very much. And I like the fact that, as I've said before, the superhero genre is a broad church in which you can tell a whole bunch of different stories. And this is another way of doing that. And the fact that this is a stealth sequel makes it all the more fun. So anyway, I'm going to take another break. When I get back, I'm going to talk about a movie which does to zombie films something like what Split did to superhero movies. And it is a British film, The Girl with All the Gifts, starring Gemma Arterton, Paddy Considine, Glenn Close, and Xenia Nanua.
Rise and shine. Come on up you get. Transit.
Hello, Dr. Caldwell.
Hello, Melanie.
Morning, class.
Good morning, Miss Justina.
Once upon a time, there was a woman. The most beautiful and amazing woman in all the world.
No! You just touched her. Watch.
No, please, don't do that. They're only children. Stop it! One day, she was attacked by a monster. But then a girl came running up and killed it. And the woman said,
Melanie!
You are my special girl, and I'll never let you go.
She saved me, and you're still afraid of her?
Yeah, and you should be too.
I am producing a vaccine, and she is the main ingredient.
What am I?
Hope.
That's what you are.
I just want to live. Everyone wants that.
She loves you.
What the hell is this?
The world is falling apart. You can save people, Melanie. You can save everybody. Oh, my God.
What did you do?
I don't know why The Girl with All the Gifts didn't split a lot more awards than it did, because it's probably one of the best zombie movies of the last decade, and the decade has been replete with zombie movies, as we all know, including zombie TV series, the Santa Clarita Diet. Everything is that isn't superheroes is zombies these days. And this movie, maybe because it's English, maybe because of that, it didn't get the immense push publicity-wise that an American movie of this sort would have got. But it's definitely very much the real deal. It's the kind of zombie movie for thinking zombie fans, in a sense. Now, it was written by a guy called Mike Carey, based on his own novel, which came out a couple of years before the film. Now, Mike Carey, interesting guy, started out working for a comic book in the UK, which has legendary, and rightly legendary, status, 2000 AD. I remember picking up copies of 2000 AD myself. I didn't follow the whole run because at that stage you had to buy those kind of magazines through a news agency, and the supply was never reliable. You know, if you didn't get in and get them fast, somebody else would. Kerry then went on to write comic books like Lucifer, upon which the TV series is based. He did a whole bunch of issues in the later run of Hellblazer. He worked on X-Men Legacy, the Sandman books. He did some X-Men, some New Mutants thing. He's just basically deep into popular culture from the comic book side of things. And this movie is definitely something way beyond you would get from most graphic novels. Now, as I said, it's a zombie story, but it's actually a zombie story with a young female protagonist. And the argument, of course, can be made as to whether she's actually the protagonist or not. The movie stars Gemma Arterton as Helen Justino, who is a guard at a military base. We don't know too much about it because the story expands from a bunch of kind of bunkered rooms outwards as it progresses. She's a guard and a teacher to a whole bunch of children who are held as prisoners. They're transported in wheelchairs, shackled and handcuffed to the wheelchairs. They're treated as being really, really dangerous by the soldiers who are there. And there are strict rules on how close one can approach these children and the interactions one can have with them. Glenn Close plays Professor Saunders, who is one of the researchers who's investigating and studying these children. And as the story progresses, we learn that basically these children are zombies, but they haven't manifest the mindless, endless hunger that zombies have. Now, the cause of the zombiness in this particular one is a fungus, which at the moment only affects insects. But in this case, it's moved on to human beings and it's spread through the world, and there are rampaging zombies all over the countryside and only a few survivors left in very fortified military bases. One of which has created this base specifically so that they can study children who were born of people affected by the zombie virus but who manifested none of the mindless traits that the zombies had, even though they are themselves infected and their brains are basically wired through with this fungus. They seem to be able to function, particularly a young girl called Melanie, played by Senia Nanua, who is intelligent, friendly, bright, engaging, and creepy as well, because even though she's a prisoner and every day she has the same ritual of sitting in the wheelchair waiting for them to come and get her and bind her up and take her to school, she says hello to everybody very politely. She's really a personable kid, though the argument could be made that the fungus in her is using her mental state to make her personable, because that may then give the fungus an opportunity to spread. Very smart fungus. A few other people in this one are Paddy Considine as Eddie Parks, one of the soldiers who treats the zombie children very roughly in the manner of a soldier. We learn a lot more about his backstory during the progress of the movie, and he becomes a much more sympathetic character than he first appears during the initial phases of the children being educated in these classrooms where they're only allowed to know certain things and they're being studied. And as time goes on, we find out that some of them are also being vivisected for scientific study. Not a nice world. And we also get another actor that I like, and Dominic Tipper comes up as one of the soldiers. Dominic Tipper, you might remember, is one of the main actors in one of the best science fiction TV series of the current era. She plays Naomi Nagata in The Expanse. So this movie definitely does have a lot of diversity in the casting, particularly as far as racial diversity is concerned. And also most of the main players who are at the needle point and at the sharp edge of the plot are women, which is a little bit different from the way a lot of zombie movies are, where they can drift in the direction of being a bit of a sausage party. Anyway, inevitably, the base is overrun by the Hungries, as they're called, and a few people escape, including just to know Paddy Considine's soldier, Glenn Close's scientist, and Melanie herself. During the fracas that ensues during when the base is overrun, Melanie gets her first taste of human flesh, which then triggers the hungriness of the virus. So everything she does subsequent to that can be seen as the virus angling its way into influencing things. Now, the interesting thing is that a lot of the zombies are just very sessile unless they're disturbed. So we get some great scenes of the crew in an armoured van making their way into London, because the best way to get to Beacon, the place where all the rest of the surviving people in the UK are, is directly through London, which is not the optimum situation. So there are, and London is filled with zombies who are seem to be kind of asleep. They're in a kind of sessile, dormant state unless something like a noise arouses them, in which case they become instantly become the hungry bastards that we all know and really don't love very much. So there are some great scenes of the crew making their way through London. Now, the way they did this was really interesting, because it's very difficult to get large parts of London to look like they've been abandoned for a number of years. So what the film crew did was partly basically using computer-generated enhancements to make existing scenes around, they actually filmed part of it in the West Midlands around Birmingham. So they did a lot of digital painting over to make it look very, very kind of run down with trees growing through it and moss and other things that are going to happen to any decaying urban landscape. And all of that stuff is done extremely well. What they also did, showing their smarts there, is they did a lot of drone flights over a Ukrainian town called Pripyat, which is part of the Chernobyl exclusion zone from 1986. So they flew over a whole bunch of those buildings. We've all seen the pictures on YouTube and things like that of the Chernobyl area where nature is reclaiming what was a very kind of heavily populated urban area after the Chernobyl nuclear spill. And they incorporated that really seamlessly into the landscapes that the people are traveling through. So it makes for a very effective post-apocalyptic world through which the characters are traveling. You know, I just love the fact that they did it that way, and they've done it incredibly effectively. One of the other things that the team find as they're traveling through London is that the fungus is making enormous spore colonies out of the dead bodies of the zombies who, for some reason, are more advanced than others. And so there are immense spore pods growing up, say, the BT Tower in London, forming an enormous kind of organic growth over this enormous tower in London and threatening to spread spores of the disease, which has only previously been spread through direct contact, being bitten, being cut, that kind of thing. And so there's a ticking time bomb in the middle of London, and the team is trying to find what they need to do about it. They've also found a colony of children who were previously unknown, surviving children of the type that Melanie is. They formed a little kind of Lord of the Flies gang together. They're uneducated. They don't really have a language of any sort, but they're very organized, very intelligent. And one of the things they do is they start laying traps for these survivors who are traveling through London, which makes it really interesting. And of course, the thing you trap survivors traveling through an urban landscape with is food. And they do it very, very intelligently. Now, these children don't live on the same kind of food we do. They live on live game. So there's a scene where Melanie, while she's out reconnoitering for the team, eats a cat, which is kind of a gross thing. And being a cat lover, it's not something that I'd recommend to anybody to do, but it does give us the growing kind of impression and the growing information that Melanie is a totally different kind of human being than the ones we know and possibly love. She's a predator, an apex predator in a new world. And when she ultimately encounters the kind of wild children who are out there, we see them act like a pack of wild animals. We see the kind of, you need to get an alpha. They fight for dominance. They have absolutely no reluctance in killing to establish that dominance. So we're finding out that these kids are definitely a new breed of humanity. And the movie, without explicitly saying that, demonstrates it by the actions of the feral children. Ultimately, Melanie dominates them all because she's not only got smarts, but she's got education. And she seems to be a lot more intelligent than any other of these new children that exist. Meanwhile, Dr. Caldwell, played by Glenn Close, is trying to find a way to cure the infestation of this fungus and thinks that the only way this can be done is if she vivisects Melanie in order to create a cure. So the plot's established and everyone's positioned for the ultimate climax, which is, in a sense, and ultimately a fight between two different breeds of humanity as to which one is going to be the dominant form on our planet. So from the tiny beginnings where you see a girl under really arduous conditions in a little room, we get to the stage where what we're playing with is the future of the human race on a very, very, very large scale. So that sense of escalation going from one thing to the next and onwards until the ultimate climax of this movie, the escalation there is really interesting and really well done. I like the pacing of this film a lot, and I like the world it creates. Even though it's not a particularly pleasant world, there are some very confronting scenes in this movie. And one of the things that it does, which is really, I think, a very on-point kind of thing to do, is in the original novel by Mike Carey, Melanie was a blonde, pretty girl. In this case, she's still a pretty human being and a pretty girl in this sense, but she's a person of colour. And I think that that really does make a difference and gives us a different viewpoint on Melanie. When we first see her, we see a lot of white people oppressing a child of colour. And so the movie, by making that one very, very pointed difference, gives us an initial idea of who and what Melanie is, which is kind of informed and kind of infused with our knowledge of race relations and the inequalities of race relations in our society. So making that difference really does give an extra layer to the movie that it would not otherwise had. And the acting in this one is really good. Gemma Arterton's really good. Paddy Considine has always been good in everything I've ever seen him in. Glenn Close is angular and predatory and focused as a scientist, even though she's probably the villain of the piece in a very, very odd way. And Senia Nanua as Melanie, who plays things very bright and also does the physicality and the changes that the character undergoes in becoming a new feral, predatory kind of human being whenever she smells human flesh. And there are these blocker creams that people use while around the children in order not to smell like people. Senia Nanua plays that character really well, from the physical and the emotional and the kind of verbal way. There's some great acting in this, and some of the best acting is from a child. And that really does, I'm more and more, really good acting gets me there as far as a movie's concerned. Just seeing things that I haven't seen before, or seeing somebody do something specifically and really enormously well and counterintuitive and instinctive and layered, even if it's a young actor. I really like that stuff. More than spectacle and CG and everything else wonderful that happens in movies, what's engaging me most these days is really fine acting and filling out a script to create a lifelike human being. Increasingly over time, I love that stuff. Now, the movie was directed by Colm McCarthy, who has done a whole bunch of television for the most part. He did the Black Museum episode of Black Mirror. He did the pilot episode of the new TV series Krypton. He did a whole bunch of episodes of Peaky Blinders and the Bells of St. John episode of Doctor Who in 2013. Ripper Street, Sherlock, and a whole bunch of other things going back as far as kind of early 21st century TV series like Spooks and Hustle. And he does a great job of it. It really, on a fairly low budget, I'm trying to find what the budget of this film was. Let's see, it only made $2.3 million in the box office, which is fucking criminal as far as I'm concerned. The budget was £4 million, and for a movie with a budget that low, it does incredibly well. It gives you a whole world. The military base is enormous. The landscapes through which the protagonists and the characters are traveling are enormous. It's just got so much detail. When people are going through abandoned houses and abandoned apartments, the set designs are fantastic. Some of them are CG'd. You can tell that they're CG'd over normal housing stuff, just to the tiniest extent. But this movie, for £4 million, which is what, $8 or $10 million Australian dollars, it's incredibly detailed and it's incredibly good. We see immense amounts of zombies. It's an impressive piece of work. And it's one that should have got a lot more love than it got. So I recommend you see it if you haven't, because I really like the film. And I think telling a zombie movie from a different viewpoint is really good. There's another one coming up soon with Stanley Tucci in it, which is kind of not thematically totally dissimilar than this. Give me a moment. I'll find the Stanley Tucci movie that I've seen the trailer for, which kind of looks... Your Patient Zero. A movie that's coming out in August, which originally blurred from that one too. After an unprecedented global pandemic turns the majority of humanity into a violent infected, a man gifted with the ability to speak to the infected's new language leads the last survivors on a hunt for Patient Zero and a cure. Now, the movie stars Natalie Dormer, Stanley Tucci, and Matt Smith, who used to be Doctor Who, and is doing a very bad American accent in this one. It does seem to owe a little bit to the girl with all the gifts, and is playing it more as a kind of City of Pants thriller kind of thing rather than this. But Stanley Tucci as an intelligent zombie has just about got me invested in that movie, because the Tucci can do no wrong. But just a wind-up for The Girl with All the Gifts. I'm going to have to read the novel now. It's that good a movie that I really want to go back to the original source material and grok that one in fullness. But it's really, I recommend it. It's got a real gut punch of an ending, which doesn't look like a long-term solution to anything, really. But you really should see it. The acting's good. The world creation's good. And the unwinding of the plot is very, very effective. It really is a first-rate piece of work. So that's about it this time around. It's time to knock, knock, knock that naughty clock that says it's time to go, as Nancy Cato once used to say on the Magic Circle Club when I was a kid. Thanks for listening. Thank you again to the Patreon supporters, who are all uniquely wonderful, and I hope all of them have good things happening in their lives. I hope all of you have good things happening in your lives as well. I will be back next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast, and a week after that with another Martian Drive-In podcast. But while movies like Split and The Girl with All the Gifts are coming out, I'm not going to lack for things to talk about in future episodes. So thanks again for listening. I'm going to play you, of course, the credits. I really do have to get the credits redone again and thank and credit the wonderful Mr. David Cummer for supporting the podcast. He's the only person at this stage who isn't on the credits, and I'm always going to give him a mention until I get my ass together and really get those credits redone. But anyway, I might put a bit of music afterwards as well. In fact, I will. But in the meantime, here are the credits to the podcast to honour and note the fantastic Patreon supporters. I'll catch you guys later, and keep watching the skies. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, the second unit director, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our script doctor, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, the set security lead, Richard H., the set photographer, Mark D., the extra, David L., the extra, and Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.
Do nothing till you hear from me. Pay no attention to what's said. Why people tear the seams of anyone's dream is over my head. Do nothing till you hear from me. At least consider I romance. If you should take the words of everyone you've heard, I have no chance. True, I've been seen with someone new, but does that mean that I'm untrue? When we are apart, the words in my heart reveal how I feel about you. Some kiss may cloud my memories, and others' arms may hold a thrill. But please do nothing till you hear from me, and you never will. Nothing till you hear from me. Pay no attention to what's said. Why people tear the seams of anyone's dream. Mama, it's over my head. Do nothing till you hear from me. At least consider our romance. If you should take the words of others you've heard, Mama, I have no chance. True, I've been seen with someone new, but does that mean that I'm untrue? When we are apart, yes, the words in my heart reveal how I feel about you. Some kiss may cloud my memories, and others' arms may hold a thrill. Please do nothing till you hear from me. Mama, you never will.